Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with increasing rumours of war, in spite of warnings from Angela Merkel and the United States scaling down of joint exercises with Israel. On Sunday, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu called for a clear red line to stop Iran. The former Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, Flint Leverett, joins us to discuss a possible pre-election Israeli strike on Iran and the IAEA report that Iran has doubled its capacity to enrich uranium at the underground Fordo plant. Then we'll discuss what was barely mentioned at the Republican Convention, Afghanistan. Rajiv Chandrasekaran, a senior correspondent and associate editor at the Washington Post, joins us. He is the author of the new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, and we'll look into the serial blunders that have mired the U.S. in its longest war, a war in which most NATO casualties now result from Afghans turning their guns on their Western trainers. Then finally, we will look under the radar to examine blowback in the cyber wars going on now in the Gulf and elsewhere with veteran intelligence correspondent Richard Sale. We'll examine the August 15th cyber attack on Saudi Aramco and an August 29th attack against Qatar's Rasgas by malware called Shamoon, apparently in retaliation for a cyber attack on the Iranian oil industry earlier this spring by malware called Wiper. Joining us now is Flint Leverett, who directs the Iran Project at the New America Foundation, where he's also senior research fellow. He currently teaches at Pennsylvania State University School of International Affairs, and from 1992 to 2003, he served as senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about the Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He's the author of Dealing with Tehran, Assessing U.S. Diplomatic Options Towards Iran, and the forthcoming Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flint Leverett.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And I spoke last week with the former chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, who served in the Bush administration, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with a fairly alarming scenario, and a somewhat surprising one. Now, I just mentioned in the opening that Angela Merkel has apparently telephoned Prime Minister Netanyahu and urged him not to strike Iran. The U.S. has just scaled back its austere challenge exercise with Israel by a considerable amount. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey, has said the United States wants no part of a war with Iran. And all of this is happening, but of course today Prime Minister Netanyahu again called for the international community to come up with a clear red line. So what Wilkerson was saying, though, was that contrary to what we normally think of, that because of Netanyahu's close relationship with Romney, that he would attack Iran in order to help elect Romney. Colonel Wilkerson's scenario suggested that, in fact, they would do it to sort of help get Obama over the top and therefore co-opt him and own him and have him buy into their policy. What do you make of that scenario?
Well, I have the highest regard for Larry Wilkerson professionally and personally, and I almost always find myself in agreement with him. I think on this, I might have some differences in the way I read what's going on and what I think is likely to happen over what time frame where Israel is concerned. I think that Netanyahu faces two big constraints in terms of being able to carry out a strike before our election here in November. One, and this will continue to be a constraint for some time, he faces just a capacity constraint. You know, the amount of damage that Israel on its own could do to Iran's nuclear infrastructure is not all that great. Frankly, the assessment of the American military is that the new enrichment site at Fordo, which is underground hardened, that the Israelis simply can't destroy that facility from the air. They don't have the ordnance and planes and so forth that they would need to be able to target it and get the bombs down to the centrifuge chambers. And that is just a physical reality that Netanyahu or any Israeli prime minister would have to deal with. There's also a political constraint, which might be somewhat more flexible, but it's still a real constraint, which is that the prime minister of Israel doesn't have the same measure of commander-in-chief authority that, say, an American president does. And typically, these decisions in Israel to initiate the use of military force to start a war, these have to be taken on a broader basis. At a minimum, Netanyahu needs to have his defense minister on board with Barak in that position. That's presumably not an issue. But he also has to have a fairly strong degree of consensus in this so-called inner security cabinet of 8 cabinet ministers. And then there's a broader 15-member defense and security committee in the cabinet. And the tradition, the expectation in Israel is that to do something like this, he would have to have very, very strong consensus in both of these bodies. And all of the indications that we have are that at least right now, today, he does not have that degree of consensus. And certainly the military leadership, the leadership of Israel's intelligence services, is pretty uniformly opposed to Israel undertaking this as a unilateral operation. And I think that makes it more difficult for Netanyahu to try and achieve this degree of consensus with his colleagues. And I think that's going to continue to be a constraint on him. Now, I think that Larry is pointing to something that's very important in what the Israelis are doing, that the Israeli military, polls would show the Israeli public, you know, they are not uncomfortable with the idea of striking Iran, but they want to do it in cooperation with the United States or have the United States just undertake the mission at some point. And so I think that an important part of what Netanyahu is doing is, in a sense, trying to influence our politics, our debate here, in ways that are going to set up the United States, whether under a reelected President Obama or under a new Romney administration, to set up the United States to undertake that mission, basically to start a war with Iran if Iran won't stand down from enriching uranium. I think that's a very important part of what Netanyahu and Barak are doing right now. I tend to think that that's going to take a longer period of time to play out than between now and November 6th. This is something that Netanyahu and Barak are working on. I think this is really going to come to a head more in 2013 under, as I said, either reelected Obama or new Romney administration, that's really when the Israelis are going to be pushing full bore for America to, from their perspective, step up to the plate and hit Iran hard. I think they understand there's really no way that they can get the Obama administration to undertake this prior to November 6th. And so what they're doing is trying to set things up for after that. At least that's the way I read it. You know, there is this argument that, well, if Israel struck, it might in some way drag the United States in. But I think that's really assuming a lot. You would have to make a lot of assumptions about how Iran responds, how then the United States responds. There would just be so many variables in that scenario that Israel couldn't control if it started down this path. I think it would be in incredibly high stakes for Israel to try and do something like that, you know, launch a strike on its own, and thinking maybe to get they could get the United States dragged in, or alternatively that somehow if they struck, Iran wouldn't really respond, and so you'd avoid all of these downsides of higher oil prices, you know, economic downturn in the West as a result that could really, you know, rebound to Israel's long-term disadvantage. So, I mean, we'll see what happens between now and November 6th, but I tend to think this is going to play out over a longer time frame, and it's really going to come to a head next year.
Again, I'm speaking with Flint Leverett, who served as the Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. And I think in many ways, George W. Bush, not only was the Iraq War, of course, the victor in the Iraq War appears to be Iran, the loser appears to be the United States and particularly the Iraqi people. But also, I think, isn't it pretty clear that that disastrous axis of evil speech happened at a time when essentially, George W. Bush cut the legs off Khatami, the reformist-minded Iranian leader who was trying to basically make some accommodation with the rest of the world and stop the isolation of Iran. And since he had his had essentially got completely undercut by Bush and by the Iraq War. And, of course, the entreaties that were made after Baghdad fell, Dick Cheney gave them the back of the hand and basically said, we don't talk to evil. And so now we're stuck with them, with what's often described as the new right in Iran. And, you know, clearly, if I just was reading the article by Ray Takai in the National Interest, All the Ayatollah's Men, that there's no question that Iran has not gone the way of China, for example, in moderating. It's as though Mao is still in charge in China in terms of what's happening in Iran. So how much do you hold the U.S. responsible for missing the opportunity to continue the moderation under Khatami, and instead we've ended up with this hardline reactionary regime?
Well, I think that it's certainly true that at the time Bush gave his Axis of Evil speech, it was his January 2002 State of the Union address. I mean, the Iranians were working with us in some incredibly positive ways in Afghanistan. My wife was directly involved in the negotiations that we had with the Iranians over Afghanistan and al-Qaeda, and they did some really amazingly helpful things for us during that period. And then, of course, say they got rewarded by being named part of the Axis of Evil. And, you know, any number of officials, Iranian officials who served under Khatami, have told us over the years that that really was very damaging to Khatami and to them, that they had really put themselves out, had really put the Islamic Republic out to work with the United States over Afghanistan, and then, you know, had gotten this response from the Bush administration. That continued just a little bit later in 2003. People forget, but in 2003, Iran agreed with Europe actually to suspend the enrichment of uranium, over which, you know, everyone is now so exercised. Iran suspended for 2 years, almost 2 years, suspended the enrichment of uranium between 2003 and 2005, while Khatami was still the president, And the idea, the hope was that, you know, this would get the United States into a serious negotiation with Iran over the nuclear issue. And Iran at the time was prepared to accept what seemed, in certainly in retrospect, seemed to be some fairly stringent limits on the scope of its enrichment activities. But the Bush administration just blew this off and wouldn't talk. They, you know, Iran just had to surrender uranium enrichment, which is something it's legally entitled to do. Now if people had the kinds of deals on the table today that were that the Iranians were willing to discuss in 2003, 2004, 2005, we would think this was a fantastic outcome. But the Bush administration just blew that, really just blew that in a very thoughtless and ideologically driven way. Now, I have a very different read than Ray Takei on, you know, our ability to deal with the current Iranian leadership. I mean, Ayatollah Khamenei has been the supreme leader both when Khatami was president. He's the supreme leader now when Ahmadinejad was president, and he's very likely to, you know, be the supreme leader for some time to come, and including after Ahmadinejad leaves office. The comparison with China and Mao, and saying it's like the Maoists are still in charge in China. Well, keep in mind, Nixon made the initial deal. The initial opening to the People's Republic of China was done when Mao was in office, while the Cultural Revolution was still going on. And I think that is the kind of attitude that we need to take toward Iran. If we try and micromanage Iranian politics, we're not going to succeed, and it's going to miss real strategic opportunities for us. We should deal with the Iranian leadership that's in place. They are prepared to make a deal. Now, it's a deal in which we are going to have to accept their right to enrich. We're going to have to accept the Islamic Republic as a legitimate political entity that represents legitimate national interests. But if we were prepared to take that approach, we could have made a deal with Khatami on that basis. We could also make a deal with an Islamic Republic with Ahmadinejad as its president on that basis. And I think, you know, Ahmadinejad is leaving office next year. Whoever his successor is, I think we would be able to make a deal with the Islamic Republic on that basis. The basic requirements that Iran is looking for a better relationship with the United States haven't really changed from Khatami to Ahmadinejad, and I don't think they'll change much when Ahmadinejad is replaced next year. You know, we have to figure out what our interests are, which I think our interests would be very, very powerfully served by an opening to Iran. And then we have to think about what that is going to take. And it's going to take a willingness to stop demanding things of Iran that they won't do, that no real self-respecting sovereign state would do, and to come to terms with them on a basis of, you know, mutual interests and mutual respect. That's a deal we need to do for our own interests, and it's a deal that I think we can do with the present Iranian leadership. And, you know, I very strongly disagree with Ray on that. I agree that we blew lots of opportunities when Khatami was president, but we are continuing to blow those opportunities.
Well, there's a lot more to ask you, but I'm afraid we've run out of time, Flint. So let's do a follow-up soon.
I'd be very happy to do that, Ian. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Flint Leverett, who directs the Iran Project at the New America Foundation, where he's also a senior research fellow. He currently teaches at Pennsylvania State University School of International Affairs, and he served as a senior director of the Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He's the author of Dealing with Tehran, Assessing U.S. Diplomatic Options Towards Iran, and the forthcoming book, Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Afghanistan with Rajiv Chandrasekaran.
We expected something, something better than before. We expected something more. Do you really think you can just put it in a safe behind a painting, lock it up and leave? Do you really think you can just put it in a safe behind a painting, lock it up and leave?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who is a senior correspondent and associate editor at The Washington Post, where he's worked since 1994. He's reported from more than a dozen countries and has served as the newspaper's bureau chief in Baghdad, Cairo, and Southeast Asia. He's the author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and one of New York Times' 10 Best Books of 2007. His most recent book just out is Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rajiv Chandrasekaran.
Good to be all here, Ian.
And clearly Afghanistan barely was mentioned at the Republican convention. In fact, the White House has pointed this out. Clint Eastwood, in his torturous 12 minutes of incoherence, talking to the empty chair, addressed the invisible Barack Obama, saying, you know, didn't you learn from what the Russians were doing? Of course, somehow Clint forgot that that George W. Bush started that war. But there was quite a lot of historical amnesia at the convention. What was your sense? Because my understanding is that actually what sold Clint Eastwood on joining the or supporting the Romney-Ryan ticket was they both told him that on day one they would get out of Afghanistan. What's your understanding of why this was a taboo subject at the convention?
Well, you know, I'm not entirely clear that if Mitt Romney were elected, he'd be out of Afghanistan on day one. In fact, I think far from it. I think if you look at Mitt Romney's other statements about the war, and I underscore other because there really were no statements out of Romney's mouth in Tampa, as you correctly stated. Romney would, in his heart of hearts, I believe, would want to keep on fighting through the end of 2014 when NATO members have agreed that the conventional combat mission is to end there. He's been critical of President Obama for imposing a deadline on the troop surge, a date by which troops would start coming home. And he's indicated that he'd favor potentially a slower reduction of forces between now and the end of 2014. So this was what makes Clint Eastwood's comments so curious. I mean, when I heard them on Thursday night, I just about rolled out of bed. It was later here in the East Coast, obviously, and it was, you know. But I'll tell you, a couple of things were remarkable about that. One was what would seem to be the sort of the mindless clapping of the audience when Eastwood was drawing the Russian parallel. You know, we should have listened to the Russians. Well, you know, that's something that people who are
pretty stridently against the war, say, I'd venture to say that the vast majority of people in that crowd are probably of the let's keep on fighting persuasion, yet they just sort of went along and clapped. And again, when Eastwood made reference to troops coming home very quickly, again, there was a lot of applause. Now, there is a faction within the Republican Party that no longer believes this war is worth fighting, that it's too costly, that the United States should focus its military resources on more threats that are more central to the United States as opposed to trying to nation build halfway around the world. But certainly the message that Eastwood was projecting was something that's not in keeping with where where candidate Romney is and what he would do if he were elected president.
So, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, just to touch on your book, because it's an extraordinary catalogue of serial blunders that have mired the United States in its longest war. And, of course, now we're witnessing the ultimate tragic absurdity of the killings, the fratricidal killings of NATO soldiers by their Afghan partners. Nothing, I think, puts the futility of it all in greater stark relief than that. But just to go back to the beginning, because, you know, the book is, there aren't too many heroes in the book, but to some extent Richard Holbrooke comes across as somebody at least understood what needed to be done and was never able to accomplish it. I recall, though, that when Holbrooke first got the portfolio, the first thing he wanted to do was to make a macro deal with India over Kashmir, understanding that the Pakistanis had their interests in controlling or at least having influence over Afghanistan, and that until you got rid of the malignant influence of the Pakistani army over Pakistan's politics, you wouldn't have a snowball's chance in hell of succeeding in Afghanistan. And what happened there? Just because my understanding, you know, that basically the Indian lobby blocked it. I don't know what happened, but it never got off the ground.
Ian, you're totally right about that. Holbrooke did believe that the path to peace in Afghanistan runs through Kashmir, which is essentially at the heart of the India-Pakistan conflict. Totally right. And Holbrooke believed that needed to be addressed. And yes, you're right. The Indian government did not want its disputes with Pakistan to be part of a broader multinational effort to try to pacify Afghanistan, did not want to be told that it would have to make any compromises to help save Afghanistan, and did not want the United States and other powers to be involved in the settlement of that dispute. The New Delhi government believes very strongly that that conflict and that dispute needs to be handled bilaterally between India and Pakistan. But you're touching in here on a fundamental truth about this part of the world, and I write about it in my book Little America. You know, there's no way Pakistan will ever behave appropriately, will ever be an honest broker with regard to Afghanistan until the conflict with India is resolved. And it comes down to this very simple truth, which is the Pakistani military believes that it faces an existential threat from India. Put aside all the many statements from Indian officials that they have no interest in marching into Pakistan and in assuming control of that incredibly troubled country, and the reality that any conflict there would involve nuclear weapons, and, you know, it's just not going to happen. The Pakistani military has convinced the public in Pakistan that this is a very real threat, and it begins with Kashmir. And so, as a result, it cannot afford to have a peaceful Afghanistan. Why? Because if Afghanistan were left to its own devices, the Afghan government would be much more closely aligned with India than with Pakistan for a variety of reasons. And so for the Pakistani military, it can't afford to have on its rear flank a country that would be closer to its rival than itself. And so the Pakistanis insist on stirring the pot in Afghanistan, supporting the Taliban insurgency in an effort to gain leverage in Afghanistan. And so the only way you really get the Pakistanis to be honest brokers is to get this big issue of Kashmir off the table. But the Indians don't want to go there, and Holbrook, despite his initial efforts there, was very quickly slapped down, both by India as well as others in the Obama administration that recognized that if you tried to take that on, it would be a years-long task. It could potentially even make trying to solve, you know, the disputes between Israel and the Palestinians seem like a walk in the park. And so it was pushed off the table.
Well, the book, though, your book, your latest book, Rajiv Chandrasekharan, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, the title itself goes back to this surreal little American community that was created by the Morrison Knudsen Company that helped build the Hoover Dam and the San Francisco Bay Bridge. They were hired by the king of Afghanistan in the 50s, and they dammed the Helmand River and created this agricultural paradise through irrigation. But of course, the salt deposits ruined the fertility of the topsoil, and eventually the only crop that could be grown is opium. And we know that that's been fueling the conflict. But so much of the story which your book brings to the table, which I hadn't heard about before, is the bureaucratic infighting and the fecklessness of AID. And why is it that they couldn't have substituted opium with cotton? That would have solved so much of the problems.
This is one of the most, you know, ludicrous tales that I tell in the book. The Afghans wanted to grow cotton. It was a crop that they had grown in the 60s and 70s in the South. It's a crop that's ideally suited to the climatic and conditions, the soil conditions. It's labor-intensive, which means it can put regions of disaffected young men to work, the same young men who are planting roadside bombs today. It was perfect in many aspects. The problem was the U.S. Agency for International Development just hated it. It hated it because it thought that cotton just wouldn't be competitive on global markets for Afghanistan. Well, fine. Nobody's asking Afghanistan to export this or to compete in world markets. They just grow the cotton so they could stitch police uniforms and stitch carpets, the stuff that the people there have done for centuries. And then the U.S. government trotted out another excuse, which was an act of Congress passed in 1986 that essentially is a protectionist law aimed to protect king cotton in the United States. And they said, well, because of this law, we can't do anything about it. But, of course, the White House could have sought a waiver, but USA didn't want to fight for it. And, you know, it's one of these many stories I lay out in the book as to how we missed these really vital opportunities over the last couple of years. You know, Ian, I thought when I first traveled to Afghanistan in 2009, soon after Obama was inaugurated, that this administration would do things differently, would get things right in Afghanistan. And, you know, they sent a lot of talented people. But ultimately, the federal bureaucracy failed us. The Pentagon sent troops to the wrong places. USAID tried to pour too much money into the country. The State Department was too slow in dispatching people to work with the military. And ultimately, you had a White House that really just bought into what the Pentagon wanted, as opposed to sticking to its guns and listening to others. I mean, had Obama listened to Vice President Biden, to others of his civilian advisors, we wouldn't have surged this way. We wouldn't be spending this much money. And we likely would be in a pretty similar situation to where we are today. It's hard to look at this troop surge, the civilian surge, the surge of billions of reconstruction dollars, and say that it's really improved the situation there.
And, of course, we would have fewer than the over 2,000 American dead and the over 1,000 NATO dead. And meanwhile, of course, Karzai and his family and cronies continue to loot the country. It's hard to see any good that will come from this. We've only got a couple of seconds here, but can you, just in the post-conflict, if indeed they'll resume a civil war, the Taliban won't necessarily win, will it? They will be back to a kind of Northern Alliance versus the Taliban. Is that what we're going to expect after 2014?
I think you'll see some of that. I think you'll also see intra-Pashtun fighting, the Taliban versus other tribal militias, rival factions of the Taliban fighting each other, various groups of Afghan security forces fighting one another. It's going to be a messy, chaotic environment. They're not going to be clear dividing lines. A lot of people are going to be fighting a lot of people. It'll feel like the mid-1990s. And we're going to step back and say, all right, well, you know, is it mission accomplished? They're fighting amongst themselves, so it means they're not really trying to plot attacks beyond Afghan soil. But you know, you're going to look and say, boy, we sacrificed a few thousand American lives, tens of thousands of our service members badly wounded, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, and for what? And I think there will be a lingering set of questions there for the American people to address. And I only wish that both candidates were talking about this a little bit on the stump. You know, I know it's not politically expedient for either one of them to really address this, but the American people deserve a frank discussion of this war. We still have more than 70,000 troops there. Regardless of who wins, they're going to keep troops there for some years.
Well, I'm afraid, Rajiv, and I hate to do this, we have to wrap up here, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Rajiv Chandrasekaran, a senior correspondent associate at the Washington Post. He is the author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone, and his latest book just out is Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about cyber wars underway beneath the radar.
There's a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't. Protect your eyes, protect yourself from digital decay. Digital decay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Sale, who's been reporting on intelligence since the late 1970s. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and is the author of Clinton's Secret Wars. Richard Sale has written for the Washington Post and the San Francisco Examiner and served as a special correspondent for UPI for 5 years. He's the author of Traitors and the Blackstone Rangers and is currently intelligence correspondent for the Middle East Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Sale.
Well, it's nice to talk with you.
And there's a war going on under the radar, or cyber war, I should say, going on under the radar in the Middle East. There was an attack on Saudi Aramco on August the 15th, a cyber attack. And on August the 29th, there was an attack against Qatar's RasGas with a malware known as Shamoon, which is allegedly designed by the Iranians, which they have deployed in response to a malware called Wiper that was used against the Iranian oil industry earlier this spring. So we have this kind of asymmetrical warfare going on under the radar, which is also another example of the blowback or boomerang effect, right?
Well, I would just say that the real heavyweights of this kind of cyber offensive are the three major software companies in the United States. There's a guy named Brin at Google, and there's a guy named Ballmer at Microsoft, and Ellison at Oracle. And they've been working with Israel's top cyber warriors to come up with this new version of Stuxnet that can damage Iran's entire software networks. And they're working very hard at it.
So the Stuxnet, and there's another one called DuQ, right?
Yeah, oh, yes. DuQ was its mission was to reconnoiter. It was to patiently collect data. It was not a strike weapon.
I see. So let's go back then to the big attack, which was Stuxnet. And my understanding is that it was incredibly sophisticated, and it was very, very patiently infecting the Iranian nuclear program and collecting a lot of data. And it actually barely got started, or at least it didn't do as much damage as it was planned. Wasn't it detected by American antivirus people? In other words, the Iranians didn't detect it first, did they?
No, they did not.
So tell us that story, because it's pretty amazing.
Well, I think I've talked to a lot of intelligence officials, and it appears that the infection of the Iranian centrifuges was not gradual. It was Israel used agents from MEK, which was a dissident Iranian organization. They had people on the ground in Iran, and they used an old trick called a memory stick. A memory stick can be used, you can drop it in a men's room or leave it in a parking lot, and somebody will pick it up and plug it in. But in this case, somebody left it somewhere where it could be plugged in, and the infection, the rate of infection was much greater as a result.
So it happened pretty quickly then, and
yes.
But surely the Iranian technicians must have noticed these centrifuges exploding in these cascades. You know, they spin at a little under 100,000 RPM.
No, so, the virus was subtle enough that it disabled any reporting mechanism. So an Iranian technician looking at his centrifuge, he would be told that it was functioning perfectly when, in fact, it was going nuts.
I see.
It was part of the sophistication of the virus.
So tell us, Richard Sale, about how it was accidentally detected on our side, if you will, and wasn't the Iranians who figured it out first?
No, it was a U.S. Security firm that first was aware of it, and the knowledge spread among U.S. officials, actually. I think Iran was very late coming to that party.
Well, that doesn't sound like the intelligence people really, you know, did their homework on this, surely.
I don't think they... it was designed to work invisibly and quietly and to be disguised in its effects. And in that way, it achieved a lot of success.
But they weren't apparently able to stop the detection by others and keep it quiet.
Well, I mean, by the time it was discovered, it damaged, I think, over 2,000 centrifuges. And it was a warning because it was clear that we had a new version in the works, and we would use it if we had to take down, derail any intention by Iran to really produce a weapon.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Sale, who's been reporting on intelligence since the late 1970s. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the author of Clinton's Secret Wars. He has been a special correspondent for UPI for 5 years and is currently intelligence correspondent for the Middle East Times. And we're talking about cyber warfare going on in the Gulf largely between the Saudis and the Iranians, as well as between Iran and the U.S. and Israel, deploying malicious computer codes known as malware. So my understanding, though, in terms of blowback, in as much as the Iranians have deployed this malware called Shamoon that's been attacking the Saudis' oil, I think, didn't Aramco's website suddenly had a burning American flag on it? Is that...
Yes, yeah. I don't know who was behind that. It very well could be Iran. I mean, they're very much an opponent in this game. But nobody's really named the agent there.
Well, that's the whole nature of this warfare, isn't it? You have clean hands.
Oh, yeah, Yeah, there's always plausible deniability. That's part of the magic of it. But there are dimensions of this that are really truly alarming. I mean, for example, we have a $5 billion surveillance program worldwide. Most of the members of this are members of the European Union, and they do everything from censor emails to keep track of the internet and to do telephone surveillance. They also sell platforms for Trojans and other technology to disable servers and spread infection in a computer network. One of the experts I talked to said, you know, as long as you have porous technology and badly constructed networks, there will always be a way in. And people apparently have found it.
So isn't there, though, in terms of blowback and the boomerang effect, my understanding is that Stuxnet and the other one, Dooku, and all of these, this malware, when you detect it, it leaves a signature traces, which then you can turn around and use against the enemy. In other words, it would be like if you sent your latest bomber to bomb Iran, and the bomber landed in Iran, and the Iranians were able to use it and send it back our way with bombs.
Well, they're just not as good at it. I mean, that's the main thing.
But it does leave traces, doesn't it?
Sometimes. Sometimes it does, yeah.
I see.
And, it's very subtle, and it's very hard to counter, especially, you know, we had a huge Chinese-launched operation called Operation Shady Rat, and it took enormous amount of intellectual property. And it didn't steal any money, but it stole all those sorts of essential information from corporations and U.S. government agencies. And it was the theft of intellectual property is very dangerous because the Chinese were raiding law firms, patent law firms, which is like one-stop shopping. I mean, you go there once and you get everything you need and you can clear out without leaving any trace.
Well, my understanding is that this Chinese cyber attack also got into very secure Pentagon computers, and didn't it get into to the Department of Energy's nuclear weapons labs as well?
Yes, and yeah. I mean, as I say, there are all sorts of ways to do this. I know that somebody used a memory stick to compromise a very highly classified CENTCOM site. So, I mean, when you use this stuff, I mean, one guy said to me, it's like biological warfare. It can come around and it can come back and bite you in the ass.
Mm-hmm. Well, apparently the Chinese got the latest nuclear weapons design from the United States.
Well, that's what they claim. I don't know if that's really true. I mean,
Well, the U.S. claims it, at least, you know.
Okay.
So,
and I just...
So, I mean,
I thought they did. Actually, I think you're right. I think that somebody, an employee of the U.S. government, gave the Chinese the latest design for our warhead.
They did, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I remember that.
So what is then, if we know from that there's this cyber warfare going on under the radar in the Gulf, largely between the Saudis and the Iranians and the Israelis and the Americans and the Iranians.
Yes.
You mentioned China. Where else is it going on? Russia's been a big player in this too, haven't they?
Well, Russia actually, I don't think they've spent the money on technology that the Chinese have, actually. The Russians were very good in the early 1990s. They were looting U.S. banks using hundreds of millions of dollars every year. And it took a long time for the U.S. to sort of muster up the nerve and intellectual expertise to counter that.
So how much did they steal? We don't know.
We don't. I mean, the other...
And by the way, who stole the money? Was it the KGB or criminals, or a combination of both?
Probably the KGB and the U.S. Rather, the Russian military intelligence, the GRU. Mm. They're pretty adept at it, and the Russians put a lot of money into it. But nobody would talk about it. There was only one company in the United States, Citigroup, actually talked about, you know, losing billions of dollars. But the immediate reaction of U.S. companies is to clam up. They're very, very, they have a phobia about prestige or any publicity. They want to retain their prestige, and they are absolutely horrified at anything being known. And they're also not very energetic in mounting any counter response.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Sale, who's been reporting on intelligence since the 1970s. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the author of Clinton's Secret Wars. And he was a correspondent for UPI for 5 years and is currently intelligence correspondent for the Middle East Times. So when you say that the Russians, or the KGB and the GRU, stole billions from U.S. banks back in the 90s, yeah. My understanding is that on the U.S. side, they used electronic or cyber warfare to go after Milosevic, who'd stolen the entire Yugoslav treasury and I believe parked it in Cyprus and other places. So that was
a superb operation, actually.
Tell us about it. Yeah.
It was called Elephant Blanket. It was an enormous targeting exercise. They actually knew everybody in the Milosevic hierarchy, you know, what they owned, what they sold, you know, what their business interests were, how often they talked to each other, what was their ranking in the Milosevic hierarchy. And so the U.S. mounted a full-spectrum information warfare plan. It was called Elephant Blanket because it worked with a series of diagrams and an enormous 5-foot-square piece of paper, and all of it was meticulously printed in 6-point type. And it was really subtle because for the first time, I think we had special technical operations cells, which were a super secret covert effort by the U.S. military. And they really did all sorts of... They worked with espionage, psychological warfare, propaganda, information warfare. They used them all together, and it was devastating.
So they have this ability then. I mean, the world is full of criminals and despots who steal the national treasuries. Recently, there was a report on how much money is hidden abroad by kleptocrats and criminals and wealthy Americans like Mitt Romney and others. The figure that was given was $21 trillion. It could be as high as $32 trillion, the report indicated. So is that money being tracked? I mean, it seems like the NSA know who's...
Well, I think the cyber warfare people are trying to track it. I mean, this Gauss virus recently, it targeted nothing but Lebanese banks. And the whole effort was to not, they didn't steal any money, but they wanted to monitor all the dispersions in different banking operations. I think they were very much keeping a scrutiny on Hezbollah and its operations.
Well, presumably they're doing the same against Assad, right? They're trying to starve him. So his money is probably being electronically disappeared or confiscated?
I don't think they've stolen it. I just think that they have a bead on it, you know. We're very patient about this. I don't think we'd outright steal it. I think, but we could freeze it, and we could disrupt it, and we haven't, so far as I know, we haven't.
Well, I just recall during Iran-Contra that Oliver North's secretary, Fawn Hall, mistyped in some Swiss bank account numbers with money that the Saudis had sent that was supposed to be sent to the Contras, and she mistyped the number, and somebody else got the $10 million. So
no, that's very funny.
Yeah. So
certainly, I would think most of Iran's clerics, many of them, really do have Swiss bank accounts, and I'm sure that we keep track of those.
Right.
I don't think we pilfer, but I, in a case of war, I'm sure those funds would disappear or be compromised.
Right.
But so far, we haven't done that.
So, are there any countermeasures? In other words, when you say, Richard Sale, that cyber warfare is a bit like biological warfare, where,
yes,
you know, if the wind changes, you get the germs instead of the other guy. That seems like a pretty reckless threshold to cross, and we're clearly crossing it. I believe that we're even using it in Afghanistan against the Taliban, albeit on a lower level than the attacks on Iran. Presumably, there's a new version of Stuxnet that's being deployed as we speak. You know, when are we going to start waking up here? Because our systems are so much more sophisticated and therefore more vulnerable, aren't they?
Well, in the case of the Taliban, we had a jamming system that was really effective because the Taliban had this enormous network of radio frequencies, and they would announce to officials in Pakistan that they wanted to be killed. And a lot of people were killed as a result of those broadcasts. So the U.S. mounted a jamming effort using all sorts of aircraft and ground jammers, everything we had. And it really disrupted the whole network. as far as countermeasures, I just don't think corporations really don't have any sense of urgency about this.
Well, if the Citibanks and the big U.S. banks lost hundreds of millions of dollars in the 1990s, you'd think that would have got their attention.
Well, you would hope so. But, I mean, there's a the Lieberman-Collins bill. It's the it's some sort of a, you know, the Cyber Warfare Modified Act for 2012. And all of the stuff in it is, the whole program is based on a fear of companies for additional regulation. I mean, they don't even have a clear definition of what infrastructure is and how it can be placed in hazard by cyber efforts, cyber warfare. The whole thing just sounds like a complete muddle. And I don't think you're going to get any sort of united or forceful action by U.S. corporations and industry. It's just not there.
Well, just in closing, Richard Sale, you mentioned that some of the top internet mega billionaires,
yes,
from Google, Sergey Brin, and Larry Ellison,
yeah,
from Oracle, and Steve Ballmer from Microsoft.
Yes.
Presume they head up this. They're working with the intelligence community. What do you know about what kind of an operation? You know, Larry Ellison's off sailing his yachts most of the time and playing tennis, so I'm surprised that he's devoting a lot of time to this.
Well, I mean, I don't, you know, I take it at face value that they're heading this, but clearly it's their experts in the field that are really mounting the effort and doing the work and perfecting the design.
So this is a kind of government and private industry cooperative.
Yeah.
The very thing that the Romney Ryan campaigns are against.
Yeah, exactly. But it's working very well.
I see. Well, just in closing then, when do you think somebody's going to really come back, something's going to come back and bite us, if it hasn't already happened?
Well, with the Operation Shady Rats, I mean, we lost trillions and trillions of dollars. And again, the corporate response was weak and disorganized and ineffective. So the Chinese are getting very, very good at this, and we're good at it. God knows, I really don't know how, you know, how many banks abroad we loot. I mean, I just don't know, have that kind of information. But it's a very complicated and dangerous situation. And again, I think the example of biological warfare really holds in this case. It's very dangerous. It can come back and get you.
Well, Richard Sale, I thank you so much for joining us here.
No, thank you. It's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Sale, who's been reporting on intelligence since the 1970s. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the author of Clinton's Secret Wars. Richard Sale has written for the Washington Post and the San Francisco Examiner and served as a special correspondent for UPI for 5 years. He's the author of Traitors and Blackstone Rangers and is currently intelligence correspondent for the Middle East Times. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.